I want to thank everyone for having me here today, and there were a few things spoken about neurosurgeons yesterday, and I hope to fulfill all of your thoughts about what we are. So what I'm going to be talking about today is patterns and location of high-frequency stimulation-induced modulation of pathological PD dynamics. And without further ado, many of you have seen multiple pictures of the components of DBS in prior talks. So you have a battery that's implanted in the chest area, just like a pacemaker. And then the electrode gets implanted in the brain in one of a few pretty stereotypical locations for Parkinson's disease. And here is a lateral view. This is actually a scout for a CT scan. It's essentially an X-ray. And you can see that the electrodes are placed pretty darn deep. They're placed essentially all the way through the cortex into the deep nuclei, and the STN is actually in the superior portion of the midbrain. So you're actually, in a sense, outside of the brain in the midbrain there. And here's a patient who has one of these large head frames on, and the head frame is on the patient here. Here is the drive, the mechanism for placing the electrodes down into the brain. So, of course, here you need a burr hole. I wanted to show you all a slightly different picture than the ones that have been presented so far. And the reason I chose this particular picture is that it kind of shows the anatomy a little bit better. So if you take the brain and you take a slice right through the frontal area right before the central sulcus, anterior to the central sulcus. So here's a slice, and you blow up the slice. And if you're looking at that, the right side here, you see the substructures of the basal ganglia. And you see that you have the striatum, the globus pallidus, and then the inputs into the thalamus from GPI and from SNPR, the final output nuclei. And the subthalamic nucleus is right here. And it's at a very, very critical location for movement, and I hope I'll convince you of that during the talk. So we just talked about the location of the STN, and this STN has somatotopy. So there's a motor subunit to the STN, and then there's the associative and limbic subunits. And here are the palatofugal fibers that we talked about a little bit yesterday. The volume that is typically stimulated by neurosurgeons with DBS is this part here. And you can see that there is some, while mostly it's motor, there is some potentially associative and even limbic areas that could be affected by your typical task. So how does DBS work? Well, that's one of the things that my group is trying to look at. And there's been many, many hypotheses about how it works, whether it's a lesioning effect and some of the problems associated with the possibility that it's a lesion effect. And I think that that's, as has been said yesterday, that that thought has been pretty much debunked as a cause of, as a mechanism for DBS. And another thought has been jamming, introduction of high-frequency noise, but then how do you differentiate noise from meaningful signal? So we're looking for an alternative explanation, something else that could potentially explain why DBS is working as it is. So how do we start in that process? Well, let's start at what we do know rather than what we're guessing at. And what we do know is that clinically, DBS efficacy is frequency dependent. We know that from, you know, implanting many patients and adjusting their frequencies, the frequency of the stimulator. And we know that high-frequency stimulation greater than 100 hertz provides the greatest clinical benefit, while low-frequency stimulation provides no real benefit. And at times, it seems some people have reported that it exacerbates symptoms. So we want to go back to the basics. We want to figure out what is the pathological activity in the STN of Parkinson's disease patients. And this has been reported, and most, you know, papers indicate that there is hyperactivity, although some have said that there's a decrease in activity. And later on, I'll try to argue that the degree of activity may not be the most important thing. We see burst pattern spiking, and we also see this beta oscillatory activity power or power that has been talked about quite a bit. So our hypothesis is that we're looking for something. We're looking for something that alters the pathological activity of the basal ganglia circuit that is not induced by LFS. Okay, so whatever it is that is causing the beneficial effect of DBS, it alters this activity, the activity that we see, that seems always to be associated with Parkinson's, the rigidity and tremor and so on and so forth. But this physiological signal cannot be induced by LFS, it wouldn't make sense. Okay, so our experimental procedure, what we do is we have bilateral DBS implantation. We actually do both sides at once. We actually do not use the large head frame because the large head frame only allows you to do one side at a time. So we use a different method that we can talk about offline. The Bengay arrays are implanted simultaneously, one side and then the other. But what I mean is that you can have the microelectrodes in place at the same time. The microelectrode recording is performed to map the STN, and the DBS lead placement is performed on one side, but not the other. Okay, so the DBS lead is not the microelectrode, and when we implant that onto here, the right side, then we record on this left side. Why do we do that? Well, the reason we do that is that we found when we try to record on the same side that we implant the permanent electrode, when we try to record, for example, while you're doing the microelectrode step prior to the lead placement, you can try to stimulate using the cuff and record using the microelectrode tip. The cuff gives you LFP information. The tip gives you single unit activity. Does everybody understand that? Okay. So you can do that. You can try to stimulate using the cuff and then record single units. But what happens is that your signal gets swamped out. What happens is that the stimulation pulses are so much greater in magnitude than what you're trying to record from the cells that your equipment is recovering from the pulsation and you can't record well the neuronal signal. So because of that, we chose this experimental setup where we can record from the contralateral side. And when you record from the contralateral side, the contralateral STN is actually far enough away from the ipsilateral one so that the swamping out of your signal that you get with the pulsations are not as dramatic or doesn't cause you as many problems in your recordings. So what we do is we do the pulsation and we with the side that has been implanted with the lead here, we do neuronal recordings on the other side during low frequency and high frequency stim. Okay? So on the right side, we're doing the stim at low frequency and high frequency. I'm only presenting the low and the high today for simplicity's sake. We actually record at multiple frequencies to try to follow the differences as you go from low to high. Contralaterally, we're doing the microelectrode recording and obtaining single unit data. Okay, so I talked a little bit about our methods already, but just to fill in the rest, we looked at data from 8 Parkinson's patients, we used the FHC platform. So this is the platform that allows you to not use the large head frame and to implant both sides simultaneously. And we sorted our spikes that we obtained using the Plexon offline sorter. So what do we see? Well, what we see is that in the local field potential, what we see is that you have a fair amount of what everybody has talked about, which is this low frequency 20 hertz to 40 hertz signal that is present in a Parkinson's patient without stimulation. And then with HFS, with high frequency stimulation, you see that signal is decreased substantially. And that's nothing new. A lot of people have reported that. And here is the power spectrum, and you see that with stim on and stim off, you see a substantial change here in your power spectrum. And here, I'm sorry, going back, this is with high frequency stimulation, okay? And with low frequency stimulation, you see that the error bars almost meet, and there's no the significance of the difference is far, far, far less with low frequency stimulation. Here is beta modulation across all of our patients. And again, we're not presenting anything new here, but with high frequency stimulation, you see a difference between stim on and stim off. But with low frequency stimulation, the error bars completely overlap. So just to briefly reflect on this stuff, contralateral low frequency beta oscillatory activity is suppressed by HFS, but not by LFS, low frequency stimulation. So that's on the LFP level. What about on the neuronal level? And this is why we went to the contralateral side. And of course, an obvious question that no one has raised their hand to ask me yet is when you're recording in the contralateral STN and you're not directly stimulating contralateral STN, how do you know you're having an effect, right? And we know clinically that when you stimulate on one side, you do have an ipsilateral effect. The ipsilateral effect is much lower than the contralateral effect clinically, but it's there. And that's why we thought that if we looked in the contralateral STN, we would correspondingly find the changes that we saw. So in a way, while I did say that all of this has been seen before, it hasn't been reported frequently in the contralateral side, and that in and of itself is kind of interesting. So looking at the neuronal level, we're going to look at stimulation-induced activity, and we're going to look at the response to the pulse, okay? So what I term PTR. When you look at the stimulation-induced activity, we see the effect on the firing rate here. So you have, this is time, and this is firing rate here on the y-axis, and stim is in orange, okay? And you see that with stim, that the firing rate is decreased relative to the non-stim portions, and this is with high frequency. And this is just one neuron, and this is another neuron, and you know, it's binned into the millisecond time slots. And what the results here are summarized, you have for this particular neuron with high frequency, you have reduced firing rate, and you also have that with this neuron as well. And these are just two sample neurons, and if you take a population summary of the 21 neurons we looked at, then we have a 20% reduction in firing rate with high frequency stimulation, okay? With low frequency stimulation, to say this relatively quickly, you don't see that. You don't see a significant difference in firing rate, and you can kind of gather that from the plot. What about burst pattern spiking? Okay, stimulation-induced burst pattern spiking. Well, we see here the burst fraction, and here is stim on, and here is stim off, here is stim on, and here is stim off. Okay, and if you, again, take it across all neurons, you see the dramatic effect between stim on and stim off. The bursting goes down significantly. Whereas with low frequency stimulation, you see that there's no substantial effect. And here's a bit of a summary. So with HFS, there's a 30% reduction in burst pattern spiking, and with LFS, there's no significant difference in the spiking, in the bursting. Yes, exactly. So many firing within a certain span of time. I don't remember the exact parameters. So here you have a single unit activity, single unit beta activity. So the stim periods have the black bar, and the non-stim periods are in between. And you see that the firing is lower frequency when you have stim on. And and here's the corresponding figures. So again, gross pathological neuronal activity is suppressed by high-frequency stimulation, but not by low-frequency stimulation. And the question is how? How is this occurring? Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yep, all of it. So how is this occurring? Well, to look at that, we had to do some more work here, and what we did was we did some stimulation artifact removal with PCA-based clustering, and again, that was not possible on the ipsilateral side just because the signal was so perturbed. But on the contralateral side, what we could do is we could actually find the artifact, and they were stereotyped in appearance, and we were able to cluster it out. So we found that with stimulation on at high frequency, you had this period of time after each stim pulse where firing didn't really occur. And this essentially didn't occur for sure for the first 1 or 2 milliseconds, and then in the third, fourth, fifth millisecond, the firing would start up again. And this sort of entrainment, if you will, to the pulsations was once again on the contralateral side that we looked at. And here is unit A, and here is unit B, and you see that, you know, both of these units showed this very, very clear pattern. With low-frequency stimulation, you see that as well, but because low-frequency stimulation occurs, you know, the time period in between is much longer, you have far less of an effect. So then the question is, how important is this entrainment-related reorganization of the presumably stochastic type of firing that you see in the STN, in the motor STN? And we looked at cross correlations between stim off and stim on, and we then looked at autocorrelations between stim off, you know, and then compared them to autocorrelations with stim on. And here you see that with beta, burst, and firing, that with low frequency stimulation there is less than with high frequency stimulation. This is even more evident with bursting and firing than with the beta that we saw. And if you looked at cases, you know, neurons where with HFS greater than LFS versus LFS greater than HFS, you saw that it was predominantly HFS greater than LFS in terms of this reorganization that's induced by stimulation. Now, if we looked at the autocorrelation, this is what you see, right? And this is high frequency and this is low frequency, and there's a clear phenomenon here that you don't see here with low frequency. So just to summarize, you have gross suppression of pathological firing with high frequency stimulation, but not LFS, low frequency stimulation. The response to the stimulation pulse is independent of frequency. It occurs whether you have high frequency or low frequency stimulation. Okay, you get an entrainment related reorganization so that the small interpulse time lag that you see in HFS that you don't see in LFS creates a functionally relevant reorganization of the firing to the extent that it could possibly affect firing rate, it could affect, you know, other things like bursting and so on. Okay, so that's the first portion of my talk that had to do more with the effect of high-frequency stimulation mechanistically. Now I want to go and talk a little bit about this circuit and the potential to specifically target portions of the circuit so that we get a very, very, very clear effect where you're not stimulating a lot of the components of the circuit. And what I mean by that is that there is a somatotopy within all of these structures. So whether you're talking about elements of the striatum or the globus pallidus or the STN or the thalamus, all of it is somatotopically organized. And when you do DBS, well, certainly with drugs, you're going to affect things in a relatively non-specific way, right? Now, if you are talking about deep brain stimulation, well, deep brain stimulation, similarly, you can affect multiple areas of motor STN or even outside of motor STN. And there may be some portion of motor STN and of motor striatum and so on and so forth, globus pallidus, that is particularly useful when you stimulate that area for an anti-Parkinsonian effect. So the other main thrust of what my group is working on is trying to identify that. And this all started when I was a resident at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And we were able to identify a group of patients that did very, very, very well clinically. And here again is my theme of going back to what you see clinically. So when you implant patients with DBS in the STN, you're going to have differences in responses. Some patients are going to do very, very well and need hardly any dopamine. And other patients are not going to do so well. And they're going to have maybe some benefit, but a low benefit. So, you know, unfortunately, most neurosurgeons, after they place the DBS, they don't go back and look to see exactly where the location was that they placed the electrode. At UNC, we did this, and through a recursive process of looking at our best patients, analyzing the clinical results, looking at the best patients, and then identifying the stimulation location, identifying where the electrode was within the motor portion of the STN, then we would go back and try to target that area. And in this process, we found that the best area to stimulate for us was 1 millimeter to 3 millimeters below the ACPC plane. And this has been reported to some degree by other authors in the posterior lateral portion of the STN. So the STN sort of slopes downwards, but downwards and laterally. But if you take the most lateral portion, it seems that the dorsalmost portion of that part of motor is what you want. So in our case series, after we did this recursive targeting, we had very high success in terms of being able to target and provide patients with benefit, and it's summarized here. And many patients were substantially better, and most patients were on monopolar settings so that we could take advantage of a smaller area of stimulation. So if you do bipolar stimulation, you have to span from one contact to another, and the area of stimulation is larger. And if you're able to target carefully the location of stimulation, then if you do monopolar stimulation, then you have a smaller ball, essentially, around the contact. Here's an example, sample patient, before revision and after revision. And many of our patients, the 27 out of 35, had results similar to this. Sri? That's right. Right. So to Sri's point, when you place a DBS electrode, and actually I don't want to flip back so many to show you, but you know, you guys have seen the DBS leads, and DBS leads have four separate contacts. And when you place it, you could use any one of those contacts or combinations of those contacts to determine where you're going to stimulate within the STN. The location that we looked at was the active contact, and because we did monopolar almost always, we could just define that one contact. Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is below the eye, right? Yeah. Right, right. So this is actually within the STN, so the palatopubic fibers are above and to the side of the STN. So this location is right below the ACPC plane, and the STN on either side medially is higher and laterally is lower, and it goes from medial to lateral, and the lateral most portion is also the posterior most portion, and in that area is your motor subunit. And if you take the most superior part of that, that's where we targeted. Okay. All right. So one patient that in particular that drives this home pretty well, and I apologize that some of you have seen this already. You have to sit through it again. this is a pretty typical kind of video of Parkinson patients, right? And this is a patient who pre-op already had a DBS system implanted, and he whether he had the stimulator turned on or left off, he was like this. Okay. And this slide shows the difference in position. We got the patient; the electrodes were just slightly off. I think the distance here was about 1.5 millimeters, and we replaced them. And this is the post-op. That's right. So one thing we did to help us target the location better is we tried to use proximal landmarks, right? So most people implant the DBS electrodes using coordinates off of the ACPC line. So, you know, certain amount lateral, certain amount posterior, et cetera. And the ACPC line is a line that was used way back when you didn't have MRI, when you had essentially X-ray, and you instilled dye into the ventricles, and then you took multiple shots X-rays to try to figure out where you are in the brain, and it was a huge advance, ventriculography, because for the first time you can determine where things are within the skull to some degree of accuracy. But the ACPC line goes all the way back to those days when you could look and find the anterior commissure and the posterior commissure, draw a line in between, and then figure out, you know, where you want to implant your electrode based on that. Today, we have MRI imaging where you can see the red nucleus and you can see the internal capsule and so on. So it makes a lot more sense to use local landmarks to determine where you're going to implant your electrode. So we did that. And here is a very typical spike train that you see with a beta oscillation that's attenuated, you know, if you move during movement, and is eliminated in DBS. And what I wanted to discuss today is the anatomical dependence of the benefit that you get from STN-DBS, high frequency STN-DBS. What we did was we looked at different locations, stimulating different locations in motor STN. So between contact 0 and 1, between contact 1 and 2, and between contacts 3 and 4. And the reason I show this particular picture is because this is the pretty typical implantation that we perform where, you know, contact 0 is down here. It's still within the STN, but contact 4 is out of the STN, above the STN. And here is our analysis of the microelectro recordings that we obtained. And once again, here is your lead with 0 contact, 1 contact, 2 contact, and 3 contact. And here's the data. And what you see with firing rate, beta oscillation, and burst fraction. So this panel here is the 2-3 location. This panel here is the 1-2 location. And this panel here is the 0-1 location. And just to, for a moment, look at the 1-2 location, which corresponds with the sweet spot that we identified clinically, we see that you have a decrease in firing rate during stimulation compared to not when you're not stimulating. Okay, and this is, of course, with high frequency. And beta power seems to decrease. Okay, and burst fraction substantially decreases. And you see that that is not the case with low frequency stimulation. Okay, and you see that the pattern changes at the different locations to a degree that you would not expect sometimes. And let me summarize that in the following diagrams. So in the sweet spot, the firing rate, the sweet spot we're terming C12, okay, the location in the middle. And you see that the relative percent difference between suppression and elevation of firing rate by location, you see that in this location, the suppression is much higher. And you see here that the beta power suppression is much higher. And you see here that the burstiness suppression is much higher.
These recordings
are
on the contralateral
side. That's right. They're all on the contralateral side. Okay. So to summarize, motor STN stimulation, you have more frequent, you more frequently induce suppression when compared to pre and post-stimulation periods. When you stimulate outside of motor STN, you more often characterized by elevation of pathological neuronal firing. This, I don't know that I necessarily want to talk about right now. So conclusion, stimulation induces a common effect on neuronal behavior regardless of frequency, that you have that interpulse interval with high frequency stimulation that may be the key in terms of mechanism, that the interpulse interval is sufficiently short to induce a functionally relevant reorganization of the activity you see in the STN, and that LFF cannot induce this reorganization because the interpulse interval is not short enough. And you have evidence of similar effects with a different post-stimulation neurophysiological response based on anatomical location. Okay? So I collaborate with Sri and Uri and Nancy on a project that is important to all of us, and that's trying to take some of the features that I pointed out today and creating essentially a closed-loop mechanism to adjust where your electrode will be on the fly during surgery. And if you can do the recording and get the parameters that we saw, the specific parameters that are present in the sweet spot but not elsewhere, then you can imagine imagine an automation system, which I can't explain because it's not my forte, but basically you have a controller and you have a continuous adjustment based upon what you see to the controller. And I believe all of this is from one of the abstracts that we presented last year, and you can use a neural point process model to try to accomplish this. And here is the current setup, of course, where you have the large head frame. And what you can envision is something that's a lot smarter, that looks a little bit more like the FHC system, where you automatically adjust potentially the trajectory and such based upon the findings that you record in a closed loop type of fashion. Okay, so I want to switch gears a little bit here. How much time do I have? 10 minutes? Okay, I think I can do that. Okay. I want to briefly talk about some spinal cord stimulation results, and mostly because I actually put this in last night because there were so many people interested in sort of the akinetic nature of beta, and I had the perfect example of that. So spinal cord stimulation is a stimulation, of course, of the spinal cord, but above the dura, so the electrodes are not placed within the substance of the spinal cord itself, unlike DBS. So it's laying on top of the dura, and because it's dorsal, it's primarily stimulating, when you do stimulation, it's primarily stimulating the dorsal sensory fibers, okay? And what we did was we had a PD patient who also had chronic pain, and we implanted this patient, and we treated the patient's chronic pain, but then we looked at EEG results from that patient to try to get a sense of whether we were affecting anything related to rhythms in the brain. And here is the breakdown of that. So the first panel here is the alpha rhythm, here is beta rhythm, and here is gamma. And with stim off, with low frequency stimulation, with high frequency, and then even higher frequency. Okay, and you don't get too much out of this, all of this, except to note that with low frequency stimulation, you see a dramatic response, and the response is contralateral to the location that we're stimulating in the leg. So we're stimulating the left leg, and this is the right brain, and this is electrode CV. Okay, and if you take the information at electrode CV, this is what you see. Okay, with stim off, and then with LFS, you see a larger amount of beta. And then with HFS and at 100 and at 130 hertz, you see it goes back down. You have to take my word for it, but this is, actually, I think I have a graph coming up, so you don't just have to take my word for it, that this is actually a little lower than stim off. So here is the relative power. I'm sorry that the words are a little small for those of you seated further in the back, but black is baseline, and baseline is right here, okay? And then LFS is the red, green is HFS, and blue is the higher HFS, okay? And you see that the power with LFS is substantially above all the others, okay? And then if you normalize all of this, you see that very clearly. And so that's what you see, you know, when you do the EEG. Does that correspond to anything in real life? Well, I think so. That's the most important part. And here you have no stimulation, 0 hertz, okay? And this is the UPDRS score. And the UPDRS score, when you stimulate at 20 hertz, is substantially higher, okay? And then with high-frequency stimulation, it falls back down. And we've done more, the reason why we don't show something better with HFS, in addition to not finding it, is that we actually didn't go high enough in frequency. Now, the spinal cord appears to behave differently than the brain and maybe the STN and so forth, and that's not surprising. We haven't even begun to try to characterize that. But in a subsequent patient that we did with much higher frequency, at around 300 to 400 hertz, you see this continue to drop, okay? And here is a walking time, and it just completely parallels the UPDRS. So what does this suggest? What it suggests is that beta really is anti-kinetic, okay? And to summarize, if I have enough time to do that, I want to go back to this picture, okay? And I want to go back to this picture because in this picture you have a direct pathway and the indirect pathway sort of split up, okay? And we heard yesterday a little bit from Michelle about, I went the wrong way. So this is what happens when you insert slides at the last minute. Okay, so we heard a little bit yesterday from Sri about how you can potentially change your ability to relay information from one location in the brain to another location in the brain based upon a number of factors. But the most important one to me that kept on sticking in my mind was high frequency, right? She showed that with low frequency, with low frequency here, that you would have much lower reliability in terms of transmitting your information. And of course, I realize that this is specific to thalamic relays, but I think that, and after discussing it with some folks, it's probably possible that this can be extrapolated to some degree to other circuits other than thalamic relay. But when you have a frequency which is higher, then you're in a sense more permissive. You have much higher reliability in being able to take your information and pass it on. Whereas when you have the opposite scenario, you have the opposite finding where you have difficulty getting information through. The possibility that this is occurring at the STN is very important because the STN is the final relay, if you will, before you get to GPI and then the output to the thalamus. We also know that dopamine is, in a way, permissive in that if you have higher dopaminergic tone, what you wind up doing is you support the direct pathway and you deactivate the indirect pathway. And the question is whether you're doing that with just regular firing rate analysis or if you're doing it with frequency-related phenomenon. So if you're looking at frequency-related phenomenon, then what Michelle was talking about yesterday with the M-current conductance and its relationship with the GABA current and the increase in beta that you see as a result, that creates beta that propagates through the basal ganglia, through the globus pallidus, and then through the STN. And in a way, the reason I mention both of these is that in a way it's two sides of the same coin, where you using the same term, using the relationships that Sri had defined, you can see how information travel through the STN and onto the thalamus and to the cortex can be affected in very, very similar ways when you change the rhythm coming out of the STN versus causing a excess of beta tone that then propagates to the STN. And just to quickly summarize the talk, initially I talked a little bit about the mechanism of the DBS effect upon beta using a specific paradigm where we record it contralaterally while stimulating ipsilaterally with high frequency. We talked about how anatomically relevant certain areas of the STN might be in targeting DBS treatment and the potential significance upon automation of DBS. We talked a little bit about the antikinetic nature of beta in spinal cord stimulation, and the last part, which I kind of butchered a little, which is the potential frequency-based view of the function of the basal ganglia, that perhaps the basal ganglia and the view that firing rate is the predominant factor in the no-go and the go pathways, that perhaps it's not really firing rate that is the most important thing, but the frequency and the propagation of that frequency through the system. And lastly, I want to thank some people. I want to thank Richard Morrow, who's the movement disorder neurologist. It was his voice that you heard on that video. And Eldad Hadar is the neurosurgeon who, functional neurosurgeon that I learned most of my procedures with at UNC. Ahmad Eskandar at Mass General, who I did my fellowship with in functional neurosurgery. These are the folks in my group that did all the work. And Sri and Uri and Michelle and Nancy, who I'm collaborating with now. Thank you very much. Yes.
If you want to think in terms of relay through STN,
mm-hmm.
you mean like the obvious signal source would be the cortex, the hyperdirect pathway, as opposed
yeah.
to coming through the lobus pallidus or something, an inhibitory connection. So do you, is there evidence that you can cite that the STN relay of hyperdirect pathway input is dependent on the degree of beta and on these other activity pattern features in STN?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and I think that the hyperdirect pathway has to play a role. Whether it's the predominant role in PD is a different question, I think. So, for example, there's a very well-known phenomenon where a PD patient, you know, you get a really big cue, right? Whether it's a visual cue or auditory cue, and the PD patient all of a sudden can move in response. It's sort of like a cue-related release, if you will. And the most likely mechanism for that is the hyperdirect pathway, I think, where you have a big cortical input into the basal ganglia system directly to the STN, and it knocks the patient out of the beta rhythm that predominates. Okay. But I think, in my opinion, PD is the story of beta. There has been, many, many different proposals of how that beta comes about. And, I'm a little partial to the theory that Michelle talked about yesterday, where the striatum and it is where it comes from. And it makes a lot of sense, right? Because the striatum is where dopamine acts, and PD is known to be a disease where, you have a lack of dopamine. So, certainly there must be some effect within the striatum that leads to the cardinal features that you see clinically and the findings that we see physiologically, right? Specifically beta bursting and, so forth. So, what would be the most obvious logical piece that would answer, how this all gets put together? And that would be beta coming from that area.
Right, so beta could come from there and probably
yeah. Right.
The point could be that the beta and STN could interfere with the STN response.
That's right.
Responses to
hyperdirect. That's right. So yes, and I what I really wanted to bring across when I showed the spinal cord beta is that beta clearly is a kinetic, and whether it functions identically in all these different structures in the brain, clearly it doesn't. But there's that nature to it. That makes a lot of sense if you think of beta propagating through the basal ganglia towards the output pathways, right? And then the STN is at the output pathway. So if you have a lot of beta in the STN, then it prevents you from taking information and passing it through. On the flip side, you can counteract that with high frequency stimulation, which removes the beta.
Last between 4 to 6 months, which is unusual because
they get a, the funny thing was, I just presented the data on Berlin 2 weeks ago, and the problem was that we got a reduction on the other side, 75%. Local effects. So the interesting, I wonder whether earth input has something to do with driving the system to be
That's right. That's a wonderful observation. And clearly, the information from the muscle is going to feed back through your through various receptors to the sensory system, and then back into the basal ganglia through cortical inputs into the basal ganglia. So you can easily envision sort of a feedback loop there. The basal ganglia and the cortex, it has many different recurrent loops. So the input of tremor back into the basal ganglia probably magnifies the tremor. It might, very well could do that. Now, if you were to decrease it, right, then, you know, what we presented today in terms of the contralateral effect of ipsilateral stimulation, similarly, if you have a, you know, stimulation is reducing beta, so if you're talking about reduction of tremor tone on one side, then potentially that also crosses over to the other side.
Sure,
that's great.